Today, why in 2020 are the Oscars still so white? And a landmark week in American politics.
Sunday night, walking through Hyde Park, you can kind of see Royal Albert Hall appearing in the distance. The lights are shooting up, there's Rolls Royces looking around, police helicopters in the sky. You're aware that this is a big night, it's a big night for British film.
Hi, good evening everybody, and welcome to the EE British Academy Film Awards. Thank you for joining us for this awesome.
And as I approached, you could see the hordes of people in their black tie best. And once you got into the event itself, kind of enter through this special entrance, and you just
special entrance, not for the stars.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, gate three. That's for the journalists.
Okay, so you're walking through gate three.
Yeah. All the stars are let into the auditorium. Sir Ian McKellen tried to get into door three. He was promptly rejected and told to go around to the actual proper bit, which he did. And then we were finally let into the press conference area, which it turns out was in the basement of Royal Albert Hall.
The glamour,
exactly. Yeah, we were allowed water, which was nice.
All right, so you're at the BAFTAs, but you're in a basement watching it on the telly.
Yeah, exactly. And you're waiting for people who've won to come through and speak to you. And there's just a TV in the corner on a little bit too quietly. So everyone's kind of craning their necks, trying to listen to what people are saying.
And the BAFTA goes to Joaquin Phoenix for Joker.
Joaquin Phoenix is getting on stage because he's just won for Best Actor. And there's a kind of intake of breath. People realise this is going to be a moment. He's going to say something. We don't know exactly what it's going to be, but something's coming. And it did.
I feel very honoured and privileged to be here tonight. BAFTAs have always been very supportive of my career, and I'm deeply appreciative. But I have to say that I also feel conflicted, because so many of my fellow actors that are deserving don't have that same privilege. I think that we send a very clear message to people of color that you're not welcome here.
So Joaquin Phoenix got up and he delivered this kind of missive towards the great and good of the British film industry, in which he gave them and the industry at large a kind of dressing down about its lack of diversity when it comes to recognition and the award season.
I don't think anybody wants a handout or preferential treatment, although that's what we give ourselves every year. I think that people just want to be acknowledged and appreciated and respected for their work. This is not a self-righteous condemnation, because I'm ashamed to say that I'm part of the problem. I have not done everything in my power to ensure that the sets I work on are inclusive, but I think that it's more than just having sets that are multicultural. I think that we have to really do the hard work to truly understand systemic racism. I
was pretty stunned. It felt like a real moment, even in that small, dark basement. It felt as if this is going to be a moment that people are talking about the next day. It's going to dominate the headlines, and it did.
Last weekend at the BAFTAs, not one person of colour was nominated in any of the acting categories. At the Oscars in Hollywood this Sunday, there is just one. And Joaquin Phoenix is an overwhelming favourite to be walking onto the stage again. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, why are the Oscars still so white? Lanri Bakari, you're The Guardian's arts and culture correspondent, and we're right in the middle of award season. We saw what happened at the BAFTAs last week, and now on Sunday we've got the Oscars, where in four acting categories, men and women in best lead and supporting roles, just one person of colour has been nominated, Cynthia Erivo in Harriet. Is that because of a lack of worthy candidates?
No, there are plenty of candidates knocking around this year. You had Lupita Nyong'o for Us.
Be careful.
Jennifer Lopez for Hustlers.
It's like robbing a bank, except you get the keys. Are you in?
There's Awkwafina for The Farewell.
Shouldn't we tell her? Isn't it wrong to lie?
And there's Eddie Murphy for Dolomite Is My Name.
I will myself into being a comedian. I will myself into being a singer. I even made my own album in my goddamn living room. How come I can't be in the movies?
And it's interesting you mention Eddie Murphy, because this conversation we're having about the lack of diversity at the Oscars is hardly new. I mean, he talked about it in 1988.
At first, when they came to me and they said they wanted me to present the award for Best Picture, my management came and they told me that the Academy had picked me in. And my first reaction was to say, no, I ain't going. And I said, my manager said, but why? I have a white manager, so I tell us, but why? And I said, I'm not going because they haven't recognized black people in the motion picture industry.
Yes, he did. He gave a very famous speech in which he talked about the fact that black people or people of colour in American society were riding in the caboose, the back section of the train. And that was the same when it came to awards recognition at the Oscars.
People, I just want you to know, I'm going to give this award, but black people will not ride the caboose of society and we will not bring up the rear anymore. And I want you to recognize us. He said, well, fine, it's done. I said, no, when do I have to be there? He said, well, you don't have to get there until about 9 or 10 because it's the last award of the evening. So,
and that was seen as quite a bold statement. I think Eddie Murphy was just approaching the height of his fame and a bit of a risk for him to do that.
And from there, we had to wait another 14 years for the very first woman of colour to win Best Actress, Halle Berry, for Monsters Ball in 2002, and she gave a pretty passionate speech.
And it's for every nameless, faceless woman of colour that now has a chance because this door tonight has been opened.
Yeah, so it was kind of billed as this big breakthrough moment. Halle Berry was at the height of her powers then. And yeah, it felt as if maybe with that, coupled with Denzel Washington winning for Training Day, that this was a year in which the doors had been broken down and that we were entering a new period where it was a lot more common to see people of colour, women especially, getting the recognition that you'd expect them to get from the Academy. But that didn't happen. No other woman of colour has won that award since.
No one else who's female and not white ever. That is quite something. But in recent years, the pressure has built, hasn't it?
Yeah. So you've had 2015 was a big year where the Oscars So White hashtag took off, which actually started at the BAFTAs. A lot of people kind of forget that. But that hashtag took off. People were up in arms about it. People like Spike Lee were talking about the fact that this was, again, a kind of the Oscars and the industry failing to recognise black talent or people of colour.
So you're not going to the Oscars?
I'm going to the Knick game. Okay.
It goes further than the Academy Awards. It has to go back to the gatekeepers.
Studios.
Yes, the people who had the green light vote. Have you seen Hamilton yet?
I have seen Hamilton.
You know the song, you gotta be in the room?
Yeah.
We're not in the room.
And then it happened again the year after. And that's when you had potential boycotts, people like Will Smith, Jada Pinkett Smith saying, we're not gonna turn up to the Oscars. We're not gonna recognize this as an awards show. We're gonna take our talent somewhere else. We're not interested in it.
I think that I have to protect and fight for the ideals that make our country and make our Hollywood community great.
So in that same year, Chris Rock, who's the African-American comedian, he was the host of the show. And during the ceremony, he made quite a few jokes about the lack of diversity.
Well, I'm here at the Academy Awards, otherwise known as the White People's Choice Awards. You realize, if they nominated host, I wouldn't even get this job.
Did all of that massive pressure, I mean, that hashtag was huge, but also these huge names talking about it, start to mark the beginning of a shift?
Well, if you look forward to the next year, so the year after 2 years of pressure about Oscar So White.
And the Academy Award for Best Picture.
Moonlight wins, which is an incredible winner. I don't think anyone really picked that. Everyone thought it was going to be La La Land. Although, the next day, a lot of people were talking about the fact that there'd been this major mistake when it came to reading out the winner.
La La Land.
Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway had somehow managed to read out La La Land as the winner rather than Moonlight. The whole production crew for La La Land get on stage, and then they realise there's this huge mistake, and they then have to give the award to Moonlight.
I'm sorry. No. There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
Moonlight won.
This is not a joke.
This is not a joke. I'm afraid they read the wrong thing.
This is not a joke.
It was cringe-inducing to watch it live, and just there was a certain irony there that the Academy, when it tried to do the right thing, give an award to a winner that isn't the kind of usual winner for them, they still managed to get it spectacularly wrong.
Just hand it out to the very white film.
Yeah, who then had to hand it over to, you know, Barry Jenkins, and everybody was very embarrassed, and it wasn't what it should have been.
Okay, so that sounds positive, apart from the massive debacle on stage, but then here we are again.
Yeah, and we've been here before with these kind of false dawns, where whether it's Halle Berry or Denzel Washington or Moonlight, these big breakthrough wins where something shifts within Hollywood. And on this night, biggest night in Hollywood's history, you hand over this award and everyone gets it. And it's like, yeah, we can be more diverse and it can work and we can celebrate these films and these actors can get the recognition they deserve, and so can these directors and these writers and whoever. In reality, when you look back at those big wins, they start to look like anomalies rather than the change of something actually substantive and something that's going to continue into the future.
Okay, so lots of positive moments, but here we are in 2020 with a problem that even Prince William, as president of BAFTA, acknowledged on the weekend, perhaps not quite as spikily as Joaquin Phoenix.
Yet in 2020, and not for the first time in the last few years, we find ourselves talking again about the need to do more to ensure diversity in the sector and in the awards process. That simply cannot be right in this day and age.
But as you say, we've been talking about it for decades, and I guess there are two things to interrogate. Is there systemic racism within the award system? But also, is there systemic racism within the industry more broadly? And if we just start with that, tell me, are there obstacles that mean people of colour are not getting the roles that would then get them recognised?
Yeah, so that industry-wide issue is a defence that's put up by BAFTAs and the Oscars and all these voting bodies when this question is put to them. And they're right to a certain extent. The film industry is still incredibly white, still incredibly male. There's some systemic things in Hollywood. We've seen for a long time that the idea of having a black lead in a film and that being a thing that you are going to peg this whole multi-million dollar enterprise to is something that studios have been scared of doing. They've been reticent to do that because the thinking goes in Hollywood, these films don't travel, so they're not going to do well abroad. If you look at a film like Straight Outta Compton, which is about NWA and their story in Compton.
You're listening to Compton's very own Ice Cube, Eazy-E and Dr. Dre. I gotta tell you, you are witnessing history.
That obviously did really well abroad. And then you get a film like Black Panther, which is the first ever black superhero film.
You get to decide what kind of king you are going to be.
And again, is an absolute smash. Ryan Coogler is a very young director. I think it was his fourth film. Takes that on board and creates this huge cultural phenomenon.
That's interesting. And what about other potential obstacles to people getting into these big roles?
Well, I suppose if you look at directing, historically, it's been difficult for black directors or directors of colour. They might be able to make their first film, but then it's difficult to go on and get funding for the second or third or fourth. So a good example of this is at Sundance 1991, going back a fair bit, but I think it matters. You have two films that do really, really well at that festival. You had Slacker, which is Richard Linklater's debut, and you had Daughters of the Dust by Julie Dash.
Never forget who we is and how far we done come.
They're both amazing films. Slacker was incredibly inventive, this kind of tour around Austin, Texas, which is phenomenal, and it set Richard Linklater up as this auteur. And he's gone and obviously won the Oscar for Boyhood a few years ago. Julie Dash, I reckon a lot of people listening to this podcast will never have heard of Julie Dash before. And that's for good reason, because she's only made two features ever. And she spoke about the fact that even though that film was really, really well received at Sundance, Julie Dash could not get funded for a second feature. And she tried for decades to do that and she could not get money. So that's the issue, is that people weren't willing to risk money or give money to artists so they could go on and make that feature.
Obviously, we're talking about race, but there's a gender issue too. I mean, clearly there are categories for female actors that always have women in them, but ahead of this weekend's Oscars,
for achievement in directing, the directors branch of the Academy nominates
actor and producer Issa Rae mocked the lack of women directors on the shortlist.
Congratulations to those men. And finally,
and Natalie Portman said something similar back in 2018 at the Golden Globes.
And here
are the all-male nominees.
Yeah, so if you look at the history of the Oscars, only 5 women have ever been nominated for Best Director. That's in more than 90 years.
How many of them won?
So it's only Catherine Bigelow who won in 2009 for The Hurt Locker.
Okay, so that's the problem, as you've laid it out, within the industry, and it's very clear that there is a systematic issue going on. But everyone knows about this. Has there been progress in recent years?
I think one of the reasons this year that so many people are annoyed and angry is that they've gone out, they've watched films, and they've seen diverse films with diverse casts, diverse directors, diverse agendas, and they've been impressed by them. And then they wait for the Oscar season to come around or award season to come around, and these films are not recognised. So a lot of work's been done to try and influence the kind of films that are being made and the kind of films that get recognised at awards. So, for example, you've got the BFI diversity standards, which films need to meet if they want to be nominated for certain awards within BAFTA. Now, those are only for Outstanding British Debut and Outstanding British Film. So they're not for the major awards.
Okay, so clearly there are problems in the industry, but there has been slow progress, and films with diverse casts are clearly being made and watched. So why isn't that being translated into the award season right now?
I think it's important to note that the award season actually starts a long time before. The big film festivals like Cannes and like Venice, and especially like Venice, I think 3 of the last 5 Oscar winners have come from Venice. If you premiere there, it's seen as a great launch pad to go into the award season. So, for example, Joker.
All I have are negative thoughts.
That was a very controversial film when it showed, but it got an 8-minute standing ovation, and it kind of set up Todd Phillips and it set up Joaquin Phoenix for what we're seeing now.
So at this stage, studios basically handpick a small number of films that they're going to set on the conveyor belt towards the BAFTAs and then the Oscars. Are they picking films that are less diverse?
Well, I think this year you've got to say yes. And it makes sense if you see it from their point of view. If you're on Netflix and you spent 160 million quid getting The Irishman with Martin Scorsese, Joe Pesci, Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, and you haven't really done that well at the Oscars, this is your big chance to push it and spend some more money on it. Why would you not do that? These are all household names, so you've got a number of people who could get nominated for anything. So Marriage Story, you've got Scarlett Johansson, you've got Adam Driver, you've got Laura Dern, you've got Ray Liotta as well. They're all the kind of actors that the Academy likes that might have been nominated previously or might have won previously. It's a game, it's a calculation that they're playing.
And presumably there's a bit of a vicious circle here, which is if the studios are looking for actors who have won Oscars previously, then that is already disproportionately white people.
Exactly. That affects the if you get funding or not for your film, which means that you're never going to get on that film festival circuit, which means you're never going to get that launch pad, which means you're not going to get nominated. And it just goes on and on and on like that.
And when they have been praised for their diversity, like a couple that you mentioned in there, is there still a certain type of diverse film that seems to do well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at this year, you think of Cynthia Erivo with Harriet. She's playing Harriet Tubman, legendary kind of enslaved woman who rebelled.
I would give every last drop of blood in my veins until this monster called slavery is dead.
That seems to be the kind of character that the Academy likes. So, for example, Green Book, Mahershala Ali wins, and he's this kind of put-upon jazz musician who has to deal with this racist guy, and he doesn't react in a negative way. He kind of brings him into his circle and slowly helps him figure out that he shouldn't be a racist, which is great, obviously. 12 Years a Slave is obviously about slavery, and then you've got Moonlight, and that's probably the one that kind of stands out, something different.
And once you've passed Venice, which, as you're saying, is the start of this period that heads towards those big awards, what's next? How does it work?
So you've got a promotional spend where you are bombarding voters with promotional material. You're inviting them to screenings. You're trying to get your stars to come to screenings to do Q&As. You target certain other awards, for example, the BAFTAs, which is the second most important ones behind them. You've got the Golden Globes as well. And then you've got different things like the SAG Awards, the Writers Guild Awards. And they're good predictors of what the Oscars are going to go with, just because there's crossover between those two voting bodies.
And what's next?
So the Oscars has the Academy is made up of 9,200 people, and they are writers, directors, actors, producers, people who work within the industry, and they're asked to cast their votes on the films which are presented before them. There's no way of them enforcing whether or not you've actually seen the films. It's supposed to be an honour system, and from there you work out who's won. So Cheryl Boone Isaacs is the president of the Oscars. She's the first woman of colour to be in that position.
The Academy Board of Governors recently took concrete action and sent a message that inclusion only serves to make us all stronger.
She's taken a pretty robust approach to trying to change that voting body. So she's increased the number of people in it. There's 9,200 now, up from about 6,000 a few years ago. And those new cohorts of people who go in are much more diverse than they used to be. When she first came in, 25% of the voting body were female. That's now gone up to 32%. And for people of colour, that was at 8%, and that's gone up to 16%.
But those are still pretty low numbers. So you're basically saying that a really large majority are still white men.
Yeah, that's what the Oscar base has been built on for decades.
So clearly, the industry itself, the studios need to take action. The voting bodies, the Oscars, the BAFTAs need to take action. But one thing that was quite interesting that Joaquin Phoenix said was that he wasn't just pointing the finger, that he, like others, needed to take personal responsibility for failing to make sure the sets that he works on are inclusive. And that's been raised before by Frances McDormand when she won Best Actress at the Oscars in 2018.
Okay. So I'm hyperventilating a little bit. If I fall over, pick me up because I've got some things to say.
She went on stage and said,
I have two words to leave with you tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Inclusion rider.
Inclusion rider. What does that mean?
So an inclusion rider is something that an actor would sign, be part of their contract, which would ensure that the set would be inclusive. It would be diverse. There would be certain quotas that would need to be met for them to work on the show itself or work on the film. I mean, whether or not it'd work or not is another thing, but it's a way that actors don't just come on stage, say something about diversity and then disappear for 12 months and you never hear anything else. It's something that they can do in the background to kind of enforce change.
So look, since the BAFTAs, there's been a fierce debate about all of this, off and online. And I was interested in some tweets from the writer Stephen King, which, to be fair, he did row back from. But he said, I would never consider diversity in matters of art, only quality. It seems to me that to do otherwise would be wrong. And it's a type of argument that I've personally heard many, many times. This idea that we shouldn't stop these things being done on merit. We shouldn't be giving people an unfair leg up. But, you know, when you think about what Phoenix said, he was suggesting that white men have had a leg up for a long, long time. And that's not really what this is about. I mean, it sounds to me like you're highlighting some serious systemic problems that would hit back at that argument.
Yeah, I mean, the kind of image that Stephen King paints is this world where everything's fair and equal and people are just making these artistic choices, and somehow that kind of offends their First Amendment right if they're being told that they need to consider diversity in it. It's not that people want these films or Marriage Story or Irishman to not be made. It's just that people want recognition for the films that are being made, which are slightly different. It's not that difficult. When you look at all the statistics and look at all the figures, you can see that this is not a fair playing field. And Stephen King's position is one that says, hang on, it is a fair playing field. Stop complaining. Let's just get on with it. Make the art and let it talk for itself. But at the moment, films are being excluded on the grounds of race, or artists are, or actors are. And that's the issue. That's the nub of it.
Oh, well, it seems to me that Stephen King was persuaded by similar arguments that came piling in on him on Twitter. Look, I just want to bring it back to Joaquin Phoenix because, you know, he really, I think, I know you may not agree, was very, very good as the Joker. Phoenix is up for Best Actor at the Oscars this Sunday and is predicted to be a likely winner. What do you think he'll say this time around?
It's hard to know exactly what he's going to say. Golden Globes, it was a little bit rambling. It was kind of about veganism. It was about climate change. At BAFTAs, it was a lot more kind of focused, laser-guided, and he made some really salient points, which made people quite uncomfortable in the room, by all accounts. And I'd expect something similar again at the Oscars.
Lanray, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Lanray Bakary, to whom we are especially thankful for chatting to us, given he's come down with a touch of award season flu. Do read his stuff at theguardian.com. Coming up, a week to remember for President Trump.
Bookmarked an article but never returned to read it? You're not alone. With The Guardian's Audio Long Reads podcast, you can listen to expert writing on a diverse range of issues whenever suits you. From immigration.
At each appeal, she was refused the right to stay in the country.
to cult novelists.
He could not avoid writing murder on his list of options.
For long-form journalism without all the reading, listen to The Guardian's audio long reads wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, it can feel like every week is one for the history books when it comes to the Trump presidency, but this one certainly stood out. With the Democrats in disarray, Trump in triumph, and with the next presidential election now 9 months away, The Guardian US breaking news reporter Joan E. Grieve looks at how a week like this will play out.
This week has really been the culmination of three different storylines that have been going on in American politics for the past several months, if not really years. And the effects of them are going to reverberate far beyond even this year, potentially into the next 4 years. So the week started with the Iowa caucuses on Monday. Iowans are the first state to get to cast their ballots for who they want to see as their party's nominee. So there's been all this anticipation and all this buildup to what is often referred to as the Super Bowl of American politics. And the ending to that was extremely anticlimactic because there were actually no results made available on caucus night. The state party, the Iowa Democratic Party, had a lot of issues communicating with their local leaders in the state. And so the results from that night have only been made available in the days since. And because it is such a close race between Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders, we actually still don't know now who the winner is. There is a debate going on in the Democratic Party about if they will win in November, either by appealing to younger, more diverse voters and basically expanding the party, or if they will win by convincing voters who flipped from Barack Obama to Donald Trump to return to the Democratic Party. Certainly, if you go with the latter strategy, then having such a public show of incompetence is not the best way to convince those people that you are, in fact, the better option for leading the country. Next up in the week was President Trump's State of the Union address on Tuesday night. In terms of the speech itself, if you love President Trump, then you loved his State of the Union address.
In the past, most of the people in this room voted for a wall, but the proper wall never got built. I will get it built.
And on the flip side, if you are one of the 50% or so of Americans who disapprove of the president, then you probably did not care for it. The State of the Union was really bookended by two moments of tension between Trump and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. At the onset of the speech, when Trump arrived, it appeared that he rejected a handshake from the Democratic House Speaker. And then at the end of the speech, she, standing right behind him, tore up her paper copy of his remarks. It seemed to please many members of the Democratic base, but in terms of appealing to a wider electorate for the sake of the November elections, not just the presidential election, but also congressional races, it's unclear if that moment helped her or hurt her. Then on Wednesday, we had the final vote in the Senate on Trump's impeachment. As expected, the Republican-controlled Senate did acquit Trump. Trump is only in office today because of Senate Republicans. Interestingly, there has been some evidence that both Republicans and Democrats have seen some fundraising uptick from impeachment. So essentially, the impeachment did the job of both energizing Democrats and enraging Republicans. But in terms of the general election, a lot of this is going to come down to how does it affect those voters in the middle. Trump will probably seek to use all of these events of the past week to his advantage for the election. And yet, with that in mind, the general election is still 9 months away, which is an eternity in a Trump presidency. So there's really no way to know if these events will be top of mind for voters when they head to the polls. And in fact, if these are even the issues that Trump will still be hammering in 9 months' time.
That was Joan E. Grieve. Keep up with this story on the website. My thanks to Lanry Bakery and Joan E. Grieve. This episode was produced by Sam Colbert and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. Have a cracking weekend, and we'll be back on Monday.